From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
One was involved in blowing up a plane, killing 73 people. One fired a bazooka at the UN in 1964 when Che Guevara was speaking. Another was the trigger man in the killing of a UN Cuban diplomat.
Today, a look at the men arrested this past weekend who allegedly attempted to kill the Cuban leader in Panama. Peru's leader resigns, still no word on who the next U.S. leader will be, and eating in unsavory times. What's in the turkey you may devour on Thursday? Food irradiation, antibiotics, and other juicy tidbits. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's not known when the Florida Supreme Court will issue a ruling on the presidential vote recounts. Yesterday, the seven justices heard arguments from the Gore and Bush camps. The court did cite the need for an urgent resolution of the case. The Gore side wants hand recounts in portions of Florida to continue and to be part of the final vote tally. But the Bush side hopes the court will snuff out the manual counts, arguing they're prone to error. As the court works under one timetable, elections officials in Broward, Palm Beach, and Miami-Dade counties are laboring on their own schedules. All three are expected to continue their slow and painstaking hand recounts today. There's no recount, however, in Duval County, where more than 26,000 votes have been invalidated. An array of religious, civil rights, and political leaders are appealing to President Clinton to declare a moratorium on federal executions in the closing days of his presidency. A letter delivered to the White House today and signed by 40 people, including the former White House counsel Lloyd Cutler and several other one-time members of the Clinton administration, urged the president to, quote, prevent an unconscionable act executing individuals while the government is still determining whether gross unfairness has led to their death sentences. Organizers sought signers who they thought would have influence with the president. They include the Nobel laureate and Holocaust historian Elie Wiesel, the financier and philanthropist George Soros, members of the committee established by Clinton to study race relations in America, and three Roman Catholic bishops. A disgrace, President Alberto Fujimori has formally presented his resignation to the leader of Peru's opposition-controlled Congress. Fujimori sent the resignation letter yesterday from Japan, where he says he wants to stay for a long time, but that it has nothing to do with the scandal darkening the close of his rule. Fujimori, whose son and sister live in Japan, stressed he is not requesting political asylum. The next two in line to head Peru, the first and second vice president, said they too would resign, the latter doing so in a bitter statement hours after Fujimori's letter. Their announcements almost guarantee that Congress President Valentin Paniagua, a political moderate aligned with the opposition, will fill the interim presidency through the April 8th elections. We'll go down to Lima and speak with a former opposition member of parliament in a little while. Israeli troops killed three Palestinians in overnight clashes just hours after Israeli helicopter gunships pounded the Gaza Strip with dozens of rockets in the most punishing strike in 2 months of fighting. Citing the Israeli, quote, aggression, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak today ordered Egypt's ambassador to Israel to return home immediately. Egypt is considered a main voice of moderation in the region. Israel also prevented fuel and other supplies from reaching crowded Gaza, home to some 1 million Palestinians, and troops blocked the main north-south road, cutting the strip in half. The Israeli measures followed a school bus bombing near a Jewish settlement in Gaza yesterday, in which two Israelis were killed and nine wounded. White House drug czar Barry McCaffrey, in a speech in Bogota yesterday, predicted heavy fighting in an approaching U.S.-backed anti-drug offensive. But with what he called vital U.S. interests at stake and insurgents growing stronger through deepening ties to the drug trade, McCaffrey said he saw no alternative to the $1.3 billion effort set to get underway in January. He predicted stiff resistance to attempts by U.S.-trained Army battalions to retake coca fields and acknowledged that neighboring countries would suffer spillover effects as the offensive known as Plan Colombia drives Colombian traffickers and insurgents toward the borders. Latin American countries have been highly critical of the U.S. inflow of money and weapons into Colombia. Last week, Colombia's largest insurgency declared a freeze on peace talks in protest of U.S. military aid and lack of government action against rightist paramilitary forces. President Vladimir Putin said today that British Prime Minister Tony Blair had persuaded him that a common European defense policy did not threaten Russia and that Moscow will not try to block its development. European Union defense ministers pledged troops, ships, and planes to a rapid reaction force as a first step in building the EU's military power. And governments at the UN climate conference yesterday weighed a U.S. proposal to count farmland and forests toward pollution cuts. According to the proposal, each country would get full credit for the first 20 tons of carbon absorbed by its own forests and credit for one-third of any amount soaked up beyond that.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country. A darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee. Deep in the earth. Cover me with pretty lies. Bury my heart in wounded knee. Take out these energy companies who want the land, and they've got churches by the dozens want to guide our hand and sign our mother earth over to pollution, war, and greed.
Get bitch quick.
Bury my heart at wounded knee.
Buffy St. Marie singing Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American. I am currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not.
President Clinton, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier executive clemency?
Part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the requests for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that.
I got my dignity, my self-respect, and I'm going to carry that with me, you know, even if I die here.
Thursday on Democracy Now!, an exclusive interview with Leonard Peltier, Native American leader in prison at Leavenworth. President Clinton is considering whether to grant him executive clemency. Also on Friday on Democracy Now!, we will replay the entire interview with President Clinton done on Election Day as he talks about issues of the Middle East, U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq, why he hasn't imposed a moratorium on the death penalty or issued an executive order on racial profiling. But this time, we will be playing responses to many of his answers. That's coming up on Friday after the Leonard Peltier exclusive interview on Thursday. Right now, though, we're going down to Florida. Florida's Supreme Court pondered the issue of hand recounts today as county workers plowed on examining thousands of ballots in the hotly contested U.S. presidential election. The seven justices of the state Supreme Court are studying arguments made yesterday by competing lawyers representing Al Gore and George Bush. At issue is whether hand recount tallies in three Democratic-leaning Florida counties, which Gore hopes will overturn Bush's current lead of 930 votes, can be excluded in the final total. 2 weeks after Americans went to the polls, vote counters in at least two South Florida counties are back at work today. They'll continue reviewing ballots by hand in an attempt to assess whether Miami and Palm Beach area voters had tried to punch out votes for Gore or Bush. In Broward County, the effort took its toll when the county's elections chief resigned, saying she could no longer stand 15-hour workdays. The extraordinary turn of events in these elections has afforded many people in this country the opportunity to take a closer look at the U.S. electoral system, and many are not liking what they see. In a recent poll, two-thirds of respondents said they support reforms that would get rid of the electoral college system. Here on Democracy Now!, we've been looking at some of the alternative methods being proposed. Today, we're going to take a look at one of these, instant runoff voting. Derek Cressman joins us. He is Democracy Campaign Director for the State PIRGS, that's a Public Interest Research Group, speaking to us from Sacramento, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Derek Cressman.
Good morning, Amy.
It's nice to have you with us. So explain what instant runoff voting is.
Sure. Instant runoff voting is simply a technique that you can use for voting that ensures that the winner actually achieves a majority vote of the people, unlike the results that we've had in this presidential election and actually in the prior two presidential elections. And it works. Many people are probably familiar with this from their local elections, where we have traditional runoffs, where sometimes if no candidate emerges a clear winner, we'll narrow the field down to the top two candidates and have a runoff a few weeks later. Using the instant runoff technique, that's not required, because all you need to do is ask the voters if they'd like to list their second choice on the ballot when they go in and vote originally, and then those second choices are counted for the candidates who are eliminated in the runoff, and you can conduct a runoff election with one simple balloting. Save a lot of expense and time that way.
Hmm. Who came up with this idea?
Be honest, I can't tell you whose original idea it is. It has been in use in other places around the world, such as Australia, New Zealand, London. And it's, you know, something that's obviously only recently become available in the last 20 or 30 years with computer counting techniques, and certainly not something that the founding framers of the Constitution would have been familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Explain how instant runoff voting prevents spoiled elections.
Well, right now, when you have a third-party candidate or candidates involved in the race, such as we had this time with, you know, Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, Harry Brown, etc., voters are faced with a dilemma. Do they vote for the candidate who they most prefer, who's, you know, closest in line to their politics, or do they worry that that would result in electing their least favorite candidate, or so-called spoiling the election? And with an instant runoff voting system, you don't face that dilemma. You could vote for whoever it is that is your first choice and then put down somebody else as your second choice. And therefore, if, you know, the third-party candidate can show their true support among the electorate without having that, you know, throw the election to someone who they wouldn't prefer or spoil the election.
Mm-hmm. And how does instant runoff voting fit in with the Electoral College, or does it?
Well, one of the ways to implement instant runoff voting would be if the Electoral College was abolished and we went to direct election of the presidency. You could implement it at a national level so that all across the country voters would be able to rank candidates in order of their preference, and we'd emerge with someone who had clearly won a majority of the popular vote around the country. The other possibility, and the state of Alaska is actually considering this with a ballot question that will be on the ballot in the year 2002, is to just go state by state and have states choose their electors to the Electoral College using the instant runoff technique. That would solve the spoiler problem, and the problem where people feel like they're wasting their third votes wouldn't necessarily deal with some of the other concerns about the Electoral College that have been raised.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Derek Cressman, who is with PIRGS, the Public Interest Research Group, State PIRGS around the country. He's the Democracy Campaign Director from Sacramento, California. Derek, can you talk about the whole political landscape in Congress right now from a PIRG perspective?
Sure. One thing, obviously, that we see is that it is a very tight margin between the two parties in both the House and the Senate. I think that that will probably prevent real sweeping provisions, either things that we think would be very good from passing or things that might be very, very bad from passing. I think we'll see a lot of opportunity for little Nixon cuts to happen to environmental protections, consumer protections, and whatnot. And the reason that I expect that to happen is we just did an analysis called The Best Elections Money Can Buy that's actually posted on our website at PERG.org. We found that 93% of the time, the candidate who raised the most money won their election. And in two-thirds of the races, the candidate who won was outspending their opponent by more than 5-to-1 margin. And
what would you say to those that said, well, that's because they were more popular, they raised more money?
Yeah, you would. If that was the case, I wouldn't be so troubled. But the problem is that that money was raised from less than 1% of the population. So they were certainly popular with a tiny group of wealthy donors, but that's very different than being very popular with the voters. And so my concern is that it's that tiny group of donors that are going to be calling a lot of the shots in the Congress with things as tight as they are right now.
Instant voter runoff, one of the things you're talking about. I mean, is it your one of the stated goals of this to break the two-party system?
I don't know that that's a stated goal. I think it would have that effect because it would make it easier for third-party candidates to run and easier for voters who wanted to support those types of candidates to accurately voice their support and express the will of the electorate. And if that results in a system where voters feel like they have more choices on election day, I think that that's a good thing for the country.
And what are the numbers we have right now on Congress and the Senate in terms of the divide?
Well, I still have not yet heard the final results from Washington State and that Senate race there. So at the moment, that stands with 49 Democrats and 50 Republicans, and that could potentially move to an even situation. So that's a very tight situation. And then in the House, the margins have narrowed from what they were in the last election, so it looks as though the Republicans will have an edge of anywhere from 4 or 5 votes on any issue that would come up.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Derek Kressman, for being with us from the State PERG, Public Interest Research Group in Sacramento, California. Again, that website, www.perg.org. And as we say on the issue of voting, today we're going to take a look at how the disabled lost out in this election. From inaccessible polling places to the notorious butterfly ballot, millions of Americans had to struggle to vote. We're joined right now by Victoria Brown, who is president of National Alliance for the Disabled, speaking to us from Orange Park, Florida. She thinks that Florida has failed the disabled when it comes to voting rights. Why?
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Yes, it's good to be here. Many of the voting polls and the booths were not accessible to people with disabilities. They were turning, my understanding was in Palm Beach, they were turning people with disabilities away from the polling areas, telling them that they were not accessible. I've had some experience with that myself, and have finally switched over to the absentee ballot, which this year, to me, should prove that there's some real problems with the getting out the vote, getting the ballots to the people, disabled people who vote. The first ballot I received didn't even have the ballot inside. It just had the return envelope. I had to call our supervisor of elections, who got another one in the mail to me immediately. And when I got it, it was so small. The printing on it was so small. I had to use a magnifying page to be able to read it. I have a sight impairment, which is noted at the supervisor of elections, okay? But they don't have an accessible ballot.
Victoria Brown, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, though, find out a little more, for example, about the fact that Rhode Island is the only state in the country that publishes a Braille version of the voting guide and tactile ballots, and that out of 152,000 polling places, 29,000 are still inaccessible to wheelchair users. We're talking to Victoria Brown of the National Alliance of the Disabled, speaking to her in Orange Park, Florida. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Victoria Brown, president of the National Alliance for the Disabled, speaking to us from Orange Park, Florida. You didn't go to the polling place on November 7th on Election Day, Victoria Brown?
No. I had been informed when I voted in a county election 2 years ago that the voting facilities for disabled people were not available. And at that point in time, my caregiver and I start to make a little bit of racket. I'm also in a wheelchair. And so the man who was running the polling place put me in a back room with my ballot so I could, you know, finish it there at the polling place. It's not like thousands and thousands and thousands of disabled people haven't worked on this problem. It comes down to the states. And here we have a real battle, not just in the state of Florida, but countrywide, that states are not mandated to follow a law, the American with Disabilities Act, that would support people with disabilities in this very area.
Can you
we're kind of left out on a limb.
Can you explain what electronic voting booths are?
I have not seen one myself. I would imagine, though, that they are wheelchair level and that they have different formats for people with different types of disabilities to be able to use that polling, that machine to vote.
Looking at an article in Business Week, it says only 12 counties in the entire nation use readily available devices like touch screens in electronic voting booths, headphones. And what about TDDs, telecommunications devices for the deaf to reach the hearing impaired?
I haven't seen one in any, you know, polling area. I've never been advised that there have been any available. As a matter of fact, disabled people, they would rather have us use an absentee ballot than clog up their lines with our wheelchairs, our guide dogs, and any other assistive technology that we may need to use to get into the polling place, only to find out that there is no room for us at the end.
Now, there's been a federal law mandating accessibility in polling places since 1986. It's 14 years later. What are you demanding now? What has to be done?
If polling places have got to be made accessible to the disabled. It comes down to a state level, and then, of course, down to the local level. The majority of disabled people in this country, by the way, which is the biggest minority in this country, 54 million of that percentage, only, you know, a certain amount are of age to vote. We have got to be able somehow to have our rights validated and backed up by our state and our local government in order to be able to get into the polling place, one, and to make sure that that polling place, no matter what it takes, is accessible to people with disabilities. A TTD does not cost $1 million. A lot of people...
Costs like $35 or $40.
Exactly. And a lot of people are, you know, say that, oh, it just takes too much to get these disabled people in here, you know, the cost is phenomenal. It's not.
Apparently in Florida, 1 million Floridians with disabilities. Do you feel that we're moving forward or backward when it comes to accessibility for people, not just in Florida, but around the country to vote who have disabilities?
Backward. Hmm. Well, actually, we haven't really been able to move forward very much. So, you know, I would say we're being pushed backward.
If people want to get in touch with the National Alliance of the Disabled, where can they call or go on the web?
They can locate us on the web at http://www.naotd.org. Or they can call me at area code 904-276-2169.
That's 904-276-2169. Victoria Brown, President of National Alliance of the Disabled, thanks for joining us from Orange Park, Florida. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move south to Peru to the latest news there. Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori formally submitted his resignation yesterday from Japan, where he'd been on a stopover as he returned to Peru from a meeting of Asia-Pacific leaders. Fujimori's choice as successor quit hours later, bringing the opposition closer to assuming leadership of Peru. The scandal plagued president's plans for a second vice president to replace him were quashed when Ricardo Marquez said he too would step down to bring stability. We go right now to Javier Diaz-Canseco, who is a left opposition leader in Peru. Fujimori yesterday emerged from 4 days of seclusion in a Tokyo hotel, said he had not yet decided how long he'd stay in Japan. His sister and son live there. Speculation is mounting that he will seek to remain in the land of his ancestors after his resignation, that land being Japan. Javier Diaz-Canseco, explain the political landscape right now in Peru. Welcome to Democracy Now!
How are you? Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
I'd say that the Peruvian situation is a political situation of a very fast and complicated crisis. Fujimori has abandoned
We're gonna have to interrupt Javier Diaz-Canseco. It's a very bad line, sort of digitalizing your voice. Is there any way for you? We're gonna call you back and see if we can get a better line, and we'll speak to you in a little while. We'll move on to our next segment and then come back to you in a few minutes. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to our next segment, and then we'll come back to Peru. We're going to go to Panama, where authorities said yesterday they'll consider pressing charges against a group of Cuban exiles detained in connection with an alleged plot to kill Cuban President Fidel Castro. Cuba and Venezuela are seeking the extradition of Luis Posada Carriles, a Cuban exile who Castro says planned to assassinate him during this past weekend's Ibero-American summit. On Friday, Castro told reporters gathered for the summit that Posada and other Cuban exiles had brought arms and explosives into Panama to carry out the assassination plot. Castro announced that his government has given Panama an official note requesting that Posada and three other men detained on Friday be sent to Cuba. Under Cuban law, anyone born on the island usually considered a Cuban citizen, even if they adopt another nationality. Posada escaped from custody in Venezuela in 1985 while awaiting retrial on charges of bombing a Cuban jetliner in 1976 that killed 73 people, including much of the Cuban soccer team. He'd been using a Salvadoran passport. He is also linked to activities in support of the Nicaraguan Contras. In a 1998 interview with the New York Times, Posada was quoted as admitting involvement in the bombing of hotels in Cuba in 1997. Another detained exile, Guillermo Novo, has participated in many terrorist attacks going back to 1964, when he and his brother fired a bazooka at the UN General Assembly in protest of Che Guevara's presence in the building. A third of the men that were arrested this weekend, Pedro Ramon, a member of the exile group Omega 7, charged with the assassination and attempted assassination of Cuban diplomats. We're joined in our studio right now by Jane Franklin, author of the book Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, there's very little attention that's being paid to this latest assassination attempt. Can you explain what happened in Panama this weekend?
Well, a few months ago, Cuba sent its advanced team of investigators, which it always does when Castro is known to be traveling someplace. If there's advance notice, the terrorists also have that advance notice. So an advanced team goes to the country and just hangs out and listens and gets whatever information they can. This time they came up with very important information, and that was that four terrorists, three of whom were very well known to them, were in Panama. They arrived in Panama City last week when the Ibero-American Summit was to begin on Friday. When they realized that they were holed up in a little hotel in Panama City, they let the Venezuelan authorities know, I mean the Panamanian authorities, I'm sorry, and they detained the men after President Castro had announced that they were in Panama to kill him, part of the ongoing campaign to assassinate Fidel Castro that has now been going on for at least 41 years. So this time, the authorities in Panama actually had the courage to pick up these people. They did not let them go. They have not let them go yet. And both Venezuela and Cuba are asking for extradition of Luis Posada Carriles, who's the main terrorist involved. And Cuba is asking, in addition, for the extradition of two of the others, actually three, but they don't know who the fourth one is, evidently, yet, because he's traveling under an assumed name, probably.
So let's talk about Luis Posadas, who is a notorious figure. Give us his history.
Well, when I was doing this book, Amy, Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, I decided I could not possibly cover all the terrorists that were involved in depth. But Luis Posada, I decided to follow. He's one of the few that I chose to follow through. When the revolution occurred in 1959, he was the sales representative for Firestone in Havana. He wasn't 16 years old, like some reports have it. He was born in 1928, so he was already 30 years old. And he had a family. And he joined the CIA after the revolution, still in Cuba. When he was found out, in 1961, just before the invasion, he fled to an embassy and got safe passage out of Cuba and began to run sabotage missions for the CIA and did that for a number of years, many, many, many missions, right through the Bay of Pigs and through Operation Mongoose and so on, and through the assassination of President Kennedy, and right into 1965 when he was sent off to Venezuela, where he became an aide to the Interior Ministry and a very active member of the Venezuelan secret police. So he has this history of being in the secret police wherever he is and doing these covert activities for the CIA, and also probably now he's not in the CIA, but he's still working with them. As he says, when I can help them, I do. His most notorious act, as you mentioned earlier, was being involved in the blowing up of the jetliner in 1976, killing 73 people. And he was arrested for that with three other people because Cuba came up with the evidence. What is important about this is to see it in the context of this long state of siege, this 41-year state of siege, and to understand that Cuban intelligence is the only force that has stood between the Cuban Revolution and this campaign by the United States and by these terrorists on their own at times to overthrow the Cuban government and to control Cuba. That is the aim of this and has been the aim ever since the colonial period. When Cuba was a neo-colony, that was the aim. And the United States is seeking to restore that control.
Posada was arrested, as you said, for the bombing of the Cuban jetliner and was held in a Venezuelan jail.
Right.
How did he get out?
He was acquitted twice by a military court. You have to understand that the president of Venezuela at that time was his former boss in the secret police. So the military courts acquitted him and the other arrested people, three of them. He just walked out the front door in 1985. Many people say, including basically what he has said, is that Jorge Mascanosa, who by then was head of the Cuban American National Foundation, paid the bribes to the guards at the jail to allow Posada to escape. And Felix Rodriguez, another well-known terrorist whose career I followed also, brought Luis Posada to El Salvador to work with him in the Contra operation, which was exposed the following year when the plane was shot down. If you remember, Eugene Hassenfuss remembered or confessed that two people had been in charge of that, and they were the aliases of Felix Rodriguez and Luis Posada. So that led to the Iran-Contra hearings, and Felix Rodriguez testified to Congress that he had brought Luis Posada there to help him. One of the senators, Senator Harkin, later asked why we are not investigating the connection between Vice President Bush and Luis Posada, a well-known terrorist who was operating in the Contra operation in Central America. That question was never answered, and no investigation was made.
And Vice President Bush became President Bush.
Yes, indeed. And then as President Bush, he pardoned Orlando Bush, one of the other main terrorists who had been arrested with Luis Posada, and would have pardoned Luis Posada if he had had a chance. But Luis Posada did not come to the United States. He came occasionally, evidently, to visit his family in Miami.
We're talking to Jane Franklin, who is the author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, talking to her after last weekend's arrests of four men in Panama accused of an attempted assassination plot against Fidel Castro, who is in Panama for the Ibero-American summit.
Let me explain what he did further. He went to Honduras and was thrown out of that country for about 42 bombings that they figure he was in charge of.
Luis Posada.
Yes. When the president there was talking about reducing military spending, he was in this bombing campaign, and Honduras made him leave the country, so he returned to El Salvador in 1996 or 97. And that's when he became well-known in the press again for the bombing campaign that took place that year. He was responsible, and he admits responsibility, and in fact brags, that he was responsible for organizing the campaign of bombings in Havana and surrounding areas in Cuba in 1997, for which there were arrests. One Italian was killed, several people were wounded, and Posada was not punished by El Salvador at all. El Salvador always claimed it didn't know where he was. But, of course, the president of El Salvador is a member of ARENA, the party that said, had as its slogan during the Central American Wars, be a patriot, kill a priest. So this man was totally in sympathy with Luis Posada's activities in trying to overthrow the government of Cuba.
You mentioned President Bush. We may be seeing a new President Bush, President Bush's son, George W. Bush. But I did want to ask you after the break about both Bush and Gore's relationship with Cuba, and then ask you about the other men who were arrested. Then we're going to go back down to Lima and speak with Javier Diaz Canseco, the one of the opposition leaders in Peru, about the resignation of Fujimori. Jane Franklin's our guest. She's author of Cuba and the United States, Chronological History. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. I mean, you're painting quite an incredible picture here, Jane. This weekend, Panamanian authorities very significantly arrested four Cuban exiles, contending they're part of a group that was involved with an alleged plot to once again assassinate Cuban President Fidel Castro, who was there for the Ibero-American summit. Among those arrested was Luis Posada. Now, you said something before. You said that President Bush had pardoned Orlando Bosch, who, together with Luis Posada, was involved with the Cuban jetliner bombing?
Yes, he pardoned him because he had come to Florida. He had been released from prison because of pressure, basically by Ambassador Otto Reich, who's a whole other story I won't even try to go into here, an extremely right-wing diplomat for the United States. And he got Orlando Bosch out. And when the CIA and the FBI agreed that Orlando Bosch should be deported because of his terrorism, if you can believe this, Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, the right-wing Cuban diplomat, congressman who had been elected in the meantime, pushed President Bush to pardon him, and President Bush did. He pardoned Orlando Bosch, who's one of the main terrorists, and he's still walking around in Miami, took a big part in the Elian Gonzalez kidnapping last year.
President Bush was CIA director when the actual bombing of the jetliner
took
place.
Yes, he was, and that was done by an organization that was formed by CIA operatives during that year when he was CIA director. But let me go on to Bush and Gore. And this really, what they will do, both of them, is continue the policy that has been in place for all these years. There won't be any change, really, and they'll be just as bad and not probably any worse than the last 40-some years. There is a policy to control Cuba, to overthrow the government, because it has defied control by the United States. And as you know, the United States has acted with impunity in Latin America. I mean, during the 60s, for instance, there were these constant overthrows of governments, like the Goulart in Brazil, Arbenz in 54 in Guatemala. There was the, and it's global, there was Lumumba's assassination in the Congo. There was the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. So they were going, they fight a global war. And when they get any kind of resistance, they aim to wipe it out. And that's what they've been trying to do. And they're really surprised they haven't been able to do it. These other two people who were arrested with Luis Posada, or detained, they have not been arrested, in Panama, the third one we don't know anything about yet, but they are also in my book as major terrorists. Pedro Ramon is a member of, or was, of Omega 7 when it existed, and he was named by the leader of Omega 7 as the trigger man in two assassinations, one in New Jersey of Eulalio Jose Negrin in 1979, who was guilty of simply sending medical packages to Cuba, and of Felix Garcia Rodriguez, a Cuban diplomat, in 1980. He was the trigger man for those two assassinations. The diplomat was killed in Queens when he stopped for a traffic light. But he made a plea bargain, and this is what's so outrageous about the way the United States deals with these people. He made a plea bargain to plead guilty to an attempt to assassinate the Cuban UN ambassador, Raul Roa Correa,
and agreed admitted the bombing of the UN mission, Cuba's UN mission, and for that he got 10 years and was out. And now here he is still trying to assassinate Fidel Castro. And Guillermo Novo, another Omega 7 member, fired a bazooka at the UN General Assembly, as you said earlier, when Che Guevara was speaking there in 1964. He was involved, I have to say allegedly, because he was convicted, then that was overturned on appeal, and then he was acquitted in his second trial. But he was involved in the assassination of Orlando Letelier, the Chilean diplomat, in 1976, the same year. And also, of course, Ronnie Moffitt, who was in the car, and the wounding of her husband, who was in the car. And he was never really punished for that. He was sent to jail for 4.5 years for lying to a grand jury. And then as soon as he was out of jail, he was taken up in the wings and arms of the Cuban American National Foundation. He joined their information commission. And here he is still leading these things. I think what this all points to is a web of terrorists that still operate together. In 1976, they called themselves CORU, or the Commanders of the United Revolutionary Organizations. And they bombed and bombed and bombed Cuban facilities in countries all over Latin America, like cultural centers, airlines that dealt with Cuba and so on. And just recently, a cruise liner was going to take hundreds of U.S. citizens down from Canada, and they have said they can't do it because of the bomb threats. So this is still going on. It's nothing old. It's right here and now.
Finally, Jane Franklin, what does this mean with the four men arrested, not arrested, but detained
right.
in Panama? What's going to happen now?
Well, Venezuela has asked for the extradition of Luis Posada because he's a fugitive from their justice system, in quotes. And Hugo Chavez is now president, which is quite a different picture from having the previous president. And Cuba is asking for the extradition of all four because they're all Cubans, and Cuba regards all Cubans as citizens, even if they adopt another nationality. And so they're asking for them back on that basis, plus the fact that Luis Posada was convicted in absentia there for this bombing of the plane in 1976.
Well, Jane Franklin, I want to thank you for being with us. Jane Franklin's book is called Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. It is published by Ocean Press. Thanks.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to the resignation of the Peruvian dictator, Alberto Fujimori, and go back down to Lima to speak with Javier Diaz-Canseco, who is an opposition left leader in Lima. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, thanks for joining us, Javier Diaz-Canseco. So can you, again, give us the lay of the land right now? What's happening in Congress? You have Fujimori, who's announced his resignation, sent a letter from Japan where he says he's going to stay for a long time, that it has nothing to do with the scandal, though he has not sought political asylum there.
Well, Fujimori has, in fact, fled from Peru. He left Peru saying that he was going to a international meeting of the Asia-Pacific Agreement in Brunei, and finally he went there, where he arrived late, and he left early before the meeting ended. Practically, he did not participate in the meeting. In this trip, he picked up his brother-in-law, Mr. Aritomi, who is the ambassador of Peru in Japan for the last 10 years, and who is also known as his financial agent. And both of them flied to Singapore, where it is said that Mr. Fujimori sold several million dollars of papers in the agents that deal with actions and papers of companies. And finally, he left for Tokyo, where he actually is staying. And from there, he announced that he was resigning to the function of president. It is obvious that what Fujimori is doing is trying to leave the country so that he will make it very difficult for Peru to Commission that has been the basic identification of Fujimori's government. I'd say that Fujimori has led what we could call a narco state with Vladimiro Montesinos, who was a former CIA agent and was supported by the U.S. government for several years. With Montesinos as his partner in this political adventure, Fujimori built a political structure that was based on a very extended network of corruption that dealt with cleaning and drug traffic money with illegal and corrupt negotiations for buying arms for the army, and also with a very corrupt process of privatization of public companies that permitted Mr. Fujimori's government to deal with around $9 billion in sales of public companies. So really, what Fujimori is facing in Peru today is not the fact that his resignation will be accepted or not, but the possibility that the Congress finally decides to declare a vacancy of the president because of immoral procedure and conduct that inhabilitates him to maintain the function of president of the republic.
You mentioned
probably he will be also inhabilitated politically for life, and a political investigation will be opened so that Peru can know finally all the corruption that we have lived under Fujimori's government.
You mentioned Fujimori's partner in crime, Vladimiro Montesinos. He fled to Panama, but then apparently came back to Peru. Where is he now?
Really, nobody knows. Fujimori tried to present the idea that he was looking for Montesinos and he wanted to capture Montesinos so that he would answer to a court for the legal procedures that he was responsible of, and for the up to now more than $60 million that he has in several bank accounts in Switzerland and in other parts of the world. The fact is that Montesinos has not been captured, and if he is in Peru, which I doubt, he could only be in one place, that is under the protection of high-ranking officers of the armed forces, to which who he is strongly linked, and obviously it is Montesinos with Fujimori that has built the command of the armed forces, so they are quite loyal to his interests. And if he is in Peru, I'm absolutely sure that he is under the protection of high-ranking officers of the armed forces.
Javier Diaz-Canseco, what about Alejandro Toledo, who ran against Fujimori for Fujimori's third term but then dropped out, alleging total fraud and corruption against Fujimori, and so he took the presidency again. Now, he's returned to Peru, Toledo?
Yes, he is returned last night to Peru, interrupting a trip that he had began to the United States and Europe, and he has come back asking the Congress to declare the vacancy of the president's office and calling Congress not to accept the resignation of Fujimori, so that an investigation can be opened on the way his administration dealt with corruption and state abuse on the citizens' rights.
Finally, so what does it look like right now? Who is president, and how will that go until April, the planned elections?
Well, the first vice president resignated from his office a couple of weeks ago. And the second vice president, which is actually in charge of the presidency, has resigned yesterday
after signing several decrees in which he assigns new high-ranking officers in the armed forces. I feel that what will happen today is that after the vacancy of Fujimori is declared and the vacancy of both of the vice presidents, the president of Congress, that is Mr. Valentin Paniagua, who has been recently elected as the new president of Congress with the support of the opposition forces, will assume a provisional government and will assume as the president of this provisional government in charge of organizing the new elections, but obviously will also have the responsibility of opening a broad and thorough investigation of Fujimori's administration, and will also have to deal with a very, very difficult situation in which Peru is now in its economy. And this economic situation will also probably demand that the Peruvian administration asks other governments, in particular the United States government, to reschedule and reduce Peru's foreign debt, which is now a very big burden for the national budget in a very critical situation of Peru.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Javier Diaz-Canseco, opposition left leader in Peru. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and as we wrap up, a preview, a kind of taste of a segment on tomorrow's program, which is what that Thanksgiving dinner may contain for you. We turn now to Michael Colby in Vermont, who is editor of Food and Water Journal. He'll be joining us tomorrow as well. But for a short preview, Michael Colby, can you talk about the turkeys that people may be eating on Thursday? What's in them? What's been done to them?
Well, it's going to be a movable corporate feast featuring many, many toxins, from the turkeys to the fruits and vegetables to the dairy products. And even, surprise, surprise, if we sit down and try to enjoy some Ben and Jerry's ice cream afterward. The turkey specifically, this is the first year that meat has been approved for irradiation. That's purposely exposing the meat supply to nuclear waste products. And you've also got concerns when it comes to the meat with hormones and antibiotic residues. And then we move on to the other food groups as well. The other theme that's kind of running through the Thanksgiving meal in terms of the dangers is genetically modified organisms, which is also relatively new to the Thanksgiving table, particularly within the last few years. And now practically all the food groups contain genetically modified organisms to some extent, from the corn, the potatoes, the squash, and once again with the dairy, considering that bovine growth hormone is now extensively used in the United States.
Well, Michael Colby, we're going to talk more about this tomorrow on Democracy Now!, and we hope you'll be with us along with other people as we analyze the Thanksgiving Day meal. Michael Colby, editor of Food and Water Journal in Vermont. That does it for today's program. Again, on Thursday, an exclusive interview with Leonard Peltier from Leavenworth Prison as President Clinton considers whether to grant him clemency, executive clemency. And on Friday on Democracy Now!, we will replay the half-hour interview with President Clinton. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Special thanks to Hal Clark. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!